Psychology is all around us. Psychological elements can be seen throughout the lifespan, from birth until death. Films are a wonderful tool to explain psychological theory and occurrences in our lives. Characters interact within each frame of film's psychological concepts. The films we remember most and view multiple times engages us by capturing the presence of psychological dynamics in authentic ways. Without us even noticing, through entertainment, film fostered an exploration of psychological ideas, which has the potential to expand our thoughts as to what may be possible in our lives and our relationships with others and with ourselves. I invite you to join me, Dr. Catherine Marshall Woods, licensed psychologist and film consultant, and my guest today, Randy Messersmith, of the newly released film, Saving Faith, to discuss the best psychology in film. Hi, Randy, how are you today?
I am very well, thanks for having me today.
It was my pleasure. You have this wonderful film that goes into a lot of psychological content regarding alcoholism, substance use, and recovery called Saving Faith. Can you tell us a little bit about your film?
Yeah, sure. This is really my first foray as a first-time filmmaker, as wearing all the hats, actor and writer and co-producer and co-director. I've been an actor professionally since I was 18 years old. I've written a few things here and there, but nothing this complete. And so during 2020 COVID and the entire industry shut down, of course, I did a lot of fly fishing. And after about 10 months, I got bored and I needed a creative project. And I took a class on creating your own content, which I taught for 30 years at the high school and college level in theater and film. And so I was always, you know, pushing my students to do the same thing. I figured, well, I better do it myself. And so I wrote this script more like a writing exercise, quite frankly. And COVID gave a lot of us a lot of time for reflection. And, you know, you're at home in quarantine, and I started to reflect on a what if scenario, you know, how we make choices in our life and what could have happened. And this story sort of bubbled up, and it was a labor of love. And I wrote it for about 6 months, and I showed it to my coach, and she said, "You have to produce this." I wasn't anticipating producing it, but her encouragement made me start my own LLC in New Mexico. I decided to drive out and see a location and meet with a co-producing team called Psych Desert Productions, who ended up helping me produce the film. Three fabulous young artists that were just fantastic. I couldn't have done it without them. And it became sort of a snowball. It sort of snowballed into, okay, I guess I'm fundraising for this. I guess I'm really going to do this for real. And it wasn't just a sort of theoretical writing exercise. And so that was the culmination of what can happen when you're stuck alone in a house in quarantine.
Understood. But this film is quite rich in so many ways.
Thank you.
We actually have a clip to show our audience so then they can get a flavor as to one scene that I felt was rich, even though I feel like there were so many scenes that we could have used. But here is a bit of a taste for our individuals watching at home. Please enjoy. We'll be back.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that cannot change, courage to change the things that I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Good afternoon. This is the new open meeting of the We Ain't Dead Yet group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Zoe, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Zoe.
The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. We ask that all participants confine their discussion to their problems with alcohol. Do we have any new members or visitors present? Would you like to introduce yourself? First name only, please.
Bill.
Hey, Bill.
Hey, Bill.
What's wrong, William? Ashamed of using your real name. Well, well. What have we here? Welcome to the Convocation of Miscreants.
Randy, so this is the first opening scene of your film. It shares an individual coming into a location in order to receive support at an AA meeting. Mm-hmm. And you said that you began this film with a what-if scenario. What inspired you to write about this topic in particular?
Well, I read a wonderful book that talked about things called universal life moments. And those are those moments in our life that basically have changed us, right? Have made us who we are. Now, those moments can be positive, they can be negative, but basically they're the big things you would probably think of, you know, birth of a child or divorce or moving to a new state or even perhaps a new job or even learning a new art form, et cetera, et cetera. And so the writer in this book basically encouraged people to write down all these universal life moments and then to pick one that might be the gem of a story, you know, kernel of an idea that might be a story. And so I did that. And you know, I worked in the financial district in New York in the 80s. I was not a high-powered stockbroker. I was a proofreader. I read legal documents from 12 p.m. to 8 a.m. So I could, you know, follow my dream of being an actor. So I worked midnights. I worked in the Battery Park. And I saw a lot of these kinds of people, these really high-powered, wealthy New Yorkers who had everything, quite frankly. They had the penthouse on Fifth Avenue. They had these million-dollar jobs, the $1,000 suits. And yet they were at lunchtime Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And it struck me about how these people who had everything that other people would envy are just sort of throwing it all away. And I have some experience with Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, being in my 18th consecutive year of sobriety. And so I was familiar with the meetings. And so I decided to sort of write a story about a man who had to confront his demons at his first meeting. So it really came from how I heard stories about how generational alcoholism is, how it's handed down from grandfather to father, from fathers to sons, you know, and how terribly difficult it is to break that chain sometimes, because I felt that the conflict of the movie was really between Bill and himself and Bill and his father. I felt like there were two central conflicts, and that opportunity of being at an AA meeting allowed him to face those conflicts, where he never would have done it by himself had he not gone into that room. And that's what is so powerful about a space like that, that is a safe space where people can address their demons. And so that's what excited me, that idea. And so I started to write about that idea about a son and his father, and sort of go from there, you know, sort of invent a more dramatic scenario than my own, because it's not my personal story, but it could have been. And that's what I mean about a what if scenario. You start thinking about, I was very fortunate that I did not kill anyone, you know, or hurt anyone. So, you know, that was a powerful idea for me.
First of all, congratulations on your 18th year of recovery.
Thank you.
That is such a huge accomplishment. And I think that you touch upon so many things as you just described what inspired this film, which is how substance use doesn't necessarily skip over success, and that there are times when people believe or begin to imagine or perceive that substance use only looks a specific way. And I feel like this film helps with that, that like you mentioned, this person who comes in, who's nicely clothed and seems pretty successful, is experiencing the same demons that someone else might experience that may not be able to function as highly in the same way. This film really places that really front and center in the first scene, even regarding Bill in this time.
And the rest of the people that are at that meeting, too. I mean, you have everyone from somebody who's basically a beginner and only been to maybe a couple of meetings to Destiny, and Destiny, you know, who just got her 14-year chip at the meeting. And she represents to me that sort of, you know, the prophet in the Matrix, you know, that idea of this wise soul, you know, that basically can look at Bill and see him for who he is and also see his potential. And so she represented that person, you know, with some experience under her belt that had been through it and had been through it with her own father. That's the picture that falls out of the book, obviously, is her own father. And so at the end of the film, you know, not to give too much away, but she sees him, and she's really the one person at the meeting that truly sees him. And so we have all kinds of characters, you know what I mean? That once again, they're all working. They all have jobs. They're not on the street corner with a brown bag. They are making, you know, decent to incredible money, and they're functional, you know, very functional.
Intergenerational challenges. Many mental health issues are intergenerational, and sometimes even trauma is in the same boat, right? And so you have this character who is experiencing, and we get to see how this is passed on from generation to generation, and how that's a conflict that if one heals themselves, what does that mean for the relationship they may have with their family?
Right. And I think that's very true for myself, as for a lot of the people that I met. And, you know, whenever you truly change yourself and change your behavior and make choices, it makes people uncomfortable. I mean, it's like, you could change your hairstyle and walk in the next day, and the people at the university would be like, oh, you changed your hair, you know, you look like a different person. And so our identities, you know, are so wrapped up in what people view us as. And sometimes people are not comfortable with that, whether it's friends or, you know, family, you know, and it's a choice you have to make. And, it's certainly a life-saving choice, and it needs to be made. And so you have to just deal with that fallout if it comes. You know, people can be very supportive, and you know, you can also have people that are a bit, you know, uncomfortable, you know, with it.
You're right. You know, this is something that I feel in therapy is discussed quite frequently with individuals who are, as you're mentioning, making life choices, and sometimes a saving life choice, is that there is a consequence of the need to potentially grieve the individuals who won't be supportive or struggle to be supportive because of the change that makes them uncomfortable, that the shifting of identity or shifting of ailments even can be really challenging for individuals to accept. And it means that that person may be different in their lives. And so what does that mean for the person making the change? Is that they may have to grieve this person being in their life in the way that they have been previously.
Right, correct.
Which is, I think it makes both parties equally uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Growth is always uncomfortable.
I was going to actually say that. Thank you so much, Randy. That's perfect. Yes, we anticipate that with change and growth, that discomfort comes with it. That's part of it. Once we are comfortable, we may not be growing as much or changing as much, actually. So
true.
The more the discomfort a bit, the larger the change possibly can be.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
Why don't we take a quick break? And we have so much to discuss when it comes to this film. I wish I could have you on multiple times because we're only just talking about the first scene. So we'll delve into the rest of the film as well when we return.
Great. Thanks. Back.
I didn't know it was possible to secure a fellowship at an Ivy League school, but UDC helped me achieve that. I never dreamed having this career was possible until UDC.
Find your possible. Visit udc.edu/possible to learn more.
Welcome back. Today we have Randy Messer-Smith today talking about his film, Saving Faith. This film has numerous psychological components regarding healing and recovery from alcohol abuse. Thank you so much again for coming, Randy.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So you were able to tell us about what inspired this film. And it's been such an inspirational film as I was watching it. And I felt like this film could actually help a lot of people. When you were making this film, did you also think of the impact that it could have on individuals watching it?
Yeah, that's a really funny question because I do not have the experience of, you know, many filmmakers who set out, to make a film for a particular purpose, and they have the skill set to, you know, write that screenplay for a particular purpose or a particular audience. And I envy that because I'm a first-time filmmaker, really. Although I've been around it my whole life, professionally, mostly as an actor and a director, not as a writer. So for me, I didn't set out to write a message movie. I set out to just write a movie that was personal. And it was personal to me without it being my story, you know, once again. So it's not my story, but I wanted it to feel personal. And so that's the way I wrote it. I also wrote it, quite frankly, and quite selfishly, because I wanted to play both parts. I wanted to play the son and I wanted to play the father. I did send the script to Anthony Hopkins, who was also obviously a big proponent of sobriety, I think after 45 years. And just as a whim, but also what that could have been if just for fun, he said, yeah, I'll play Merritt. I'll play the father, and I would have just been in heaven. So, but I did want to play the father and I did want to play the son for obvious reasons, because I felt that parallel was really important, that that was done by both actors, you know, one actor, both characters. And so it also made the shooting very challenging because I didn't grow my beard for a year. And I mean, I didn't cut my beard for a year and a half. So that was me. That wasn't makeup. So I grew my hair out for COVID from 2020 to the end of 2021 when we shot the film. And so we had to shoot all of the Merritt scenes the first day with a body double. And then, of course, I had to cut it all off and do the wounds, et cetera. And then we shot all of Bill's scenes the second day with the body double in the other costume. And so just technically, it was a very complicated shoot to figure out, make sure we got all of the scenes correct. So It was really a lot of fun and highly challenging. And as I mentioned, when the film was completed, it became more apparent that this was a film that was going to appeal to certain audiences, you know, a niche film, if you will, that this film did certainly have a message. And I wanted it to have a message when I wrote it, but I also didn't want to let Bill off the hook. Bill was going to prison. He's going to pay for what he did. He's not going to get off the hook. There's not going to be a magical tie it up with a red ribbon at the end. But I also wanted an idea of hope and redemption that, you know, when destiny says to him, maybe it's time you start worshiping a different father. That was just the line that spoke to me the most in terms of the whole film, which was, now in prison, maybe Bill has an opportunity. He has an opportunity presented to him to think about maybe he could do some meetings while he's in prison for 5 years and maybe change his life when he gets out. So it didn't start out as a message movie, but the more people that saw it and professionals that commented on it, I started to target festivals that were mainly geared towards recovery. And I've shown it to some recovery centers, and the alcoholics get all the jokes at the recovery centers, which is kind of fun for me, you know, as well.
You know, that's one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we discussed is what happens to him, is that he does face real consequences for what has occurred to him within the movie. That, like you mentioned, the consequences that he's experiencing are not wrapped in a red bow. That is not necessarily something that you will say, oh, this is such a happy ending per se. And yet it does have this hope that this could potentially be a new beginning for him, mm-hmm. if he chooses that. And so it's almost as if the way that this is written is that there are consequences for one's behaviors, and there are still choices to be made even thereafter. Individuals, let's say, who may be facing jail time or prison time for offenses that they may have done, may feel like their choices are taken away from them. And this film actually, I thought, was really nice in highlighting that even under those circumstances, individuals still have choices to make even during that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned the film festivals. Tell us a little bit about where this film has been seen and where it's going.
Sure. The film was a winner of the best drama at the Texas Short Film Festival. It was a finalist at the Oregon Short Film Festival. It's played on the Austin Liftoff Global Network, which is an online festival as well. And of course, was a part of the Believe Psychology Film Festival and the Mental Health Festival, which is also an online festival. And so, as I've mentioned, it's had some play at some of these specific kind of festivals that really appreciate this kind of work. And this month, it's getting its LA on. And it actually today, it's part of the Awareness Film Festival, which is an online festival that people can watch it at the Entertainment Oxygen app. And it's a short, and you pay $12 to watch the film, or $20 to watch three of these really good films that are on this app. And all the money goes to Heal One World, which is a nonprofit organization that actually provides self-help strategies for people who can't afford it or don't have insurance. So the festival is a fundraiser. And then it's also appearing in person at the Real Recovery Film Festival in North Hollywood, on October 25th at 5 p.m. as part of the big week-long Real Recovery Festival and Symposium, where they do panels and they do workshops and they do Q&As. And so I'm excited to be there in person and talk about the film and, you know, see it once again live and in person since the premiere, which was in Las Cruces in March this year, which is where the film premiered and where I shot it, was in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And so it had its premiere there in a theater, but I'm excited to get to see it in LA in a theater coming up in end of this month.
I'm so happy that you're mentioning how many locations it is getting play. This is an important film to see, and I know that you mentioned that you're beginning to target film festivals that specifically have a mental health awareness aspect to it, which is very appropriate, obviously. And it is just also a film that it can move any audience, whether they are interested in mental health or if they're just interested in being entertained in some way and having a film that's thought-provoking. I do want to just highlight that this is not just a film for individuals who are interested right. in psychology, for an example. This is a film that I think can really be touching to many, many individuals from various walks of life.
And I appreciate you saying that, you know, because that's back to our universal life moments that we were talking about earlier. You know, it should speak to a lot of people in a lot of different ways. You know what I mean? Everybody has a relationship with alcohol, some people more intimate than others. And they might know somebody, they might know a friend, you know. And I hope that it speaks to people, you know, of all ages and backgrounds. And, you know, I think hopefully that's the appeal to the central conflict between fathers and sons, because Merritt, the father, doesn't think he's doing the wrong thing. He, in fact, that's the way his father taught him. And so he doesn't understand why his son doesn't understand that the way you become a man is to be able to take five shots by the time you're 17 years old. You know, that's what he was taught. So, you know, that is what happens, right? Merritt's not an evil person. He's just somebody that was taught a certain way. And that's what he's trying to pass on to his son, you know? And so I think there's universality in that, whether it's mothers and daughters or fathers and sons, et cetera, you know.
I agree fully. If people want to see the film, you've shared a little bit about where they can at this time. If they want to get in contact with you because they want to have a conversation about your film or also maybe show the film in some way, how can they reach you?
Sure. Well, at the official website that I have for the film, which is luckystoryproductions.com, there is, of course, info and background and videos and the press kit about the film. And at the very last page, of course, there's a contact section on the website where people can, you know, just fill in the information and contact me. Probably till the end of this year, that'll be up till the end of December. So that's certainly, you know, the best way that people can reach out if they have questions or just, you know, want to touch base and talk about certain things.
Sure. Now, last question is, this is your first film. Anything else you'll be working on in the future?
Yeah, actually, I think I mentioned I did some fly fishing in COVID times. And I've been doing that for many years. And I have an idea for a film, you know, that isn't on paper yet. I'm reading a lot of books about fly fishing. And I read a couple of books when I was younger, The Zen and Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and then also The Zen and the Art of Archery. There were a couple of books that I read when I was younger that just really spoke to me about Zen. And that certainly is my Zen, fly fishing. And so I think I want to write a film about that, about the healing aspects of water. And I don't have a character yet as far as why this person needs that. But that's where I'm headed. I think it'll be a completely different vibe than this film. I think it's going to be quite different in tone.
Well, I look forward to seeing this one in the future as well.
Great. Thank you.
Stay tuned.
Thank you very much for having me.